Recyclical, making lithium ion last forever. Recyclical's patented recycling process achieves up to 100% recovery of battery metals from lithium ion batteries for electric vehicles, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, and aluminum. Recyclical Battery Materials Incorporated trades on the TSX Venture AMY, on the OTCQB AMYZF, and Frankfurt ID4. For more information, visit recyclico.com or phone us at 778-574-4444. Recyclico, making lithium ion last forever.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. Welcome back to the show and best of the season.
Best of the season to you, and greetings from Jasper, Alberta, the normally a beautiful ski resort, and it's still a beautiful ski resort, but needs a little more snow right now.
Yeah, the Globe and Mail put an article out today saying, end of winter as we know it. I mean, back east, they're having a mild winter. But don't forget, last winter, we were setting record cold here in British Columbia, and we had lots of snow. Don't just have one winter make a whole climate change thing happen at once, I don't think.
Well, a lot of people are talking about El Nino, so I looked it up, and the cycle is every 2 to 7 years. So we've had them as close together as 2 years and as far apart as 7 years, and they usually last 1 year. And if the climate's warming, which I think the planet is warming, and on top of that, you get a 1 year El Nino, which adds another half a degree to 2 degrees, in the ocean, which could multiply into even more than that on land, then that's probably what we're going through. But the other thing about El Nino in northern U.S., it doesn't say Canada, but in northern U.S., which is pretty close to Canada, it says it usually brings wet conditions, so we still could get some pretty good snowstorms if El Nino is the cause of this.
Meanwhile, China's having record low temperatures and really bad weather, plus an earthquake.
Yes, and plus a really slow economy, too, which is scaring everybody, not just in China, but everybody all over the world, scared about that.
Yes. Now, will China be able to pull out of their real estate fiasco where they built giant cities with nobody in them?
The problem with that, pulling out, like they've done it in 2009, you and I probably talked about this before, they did a stimulus that was massive compared to the stimulus in the U.S. in 2009. And that was not a skimpy stimulus. That was a pretty robust one. But China's was several times larger than the U.S. one. And that pulled the whole world out of the 2009 global financial crisis, the stimulus. And a lot of it went into real estate, which is what happens when you order the banks to lend more money. They mostly understand lending to real estate more than anything else. So they just pump the money out the door and people buy more real estate. So this time they're trying to rescue the property sector, but people don't seem to be responding by buying more apartments. They're still worried about the apartment they bought last time, which hasn't been built yet, and the company that was supposed to build it is in bankruptcy or in some kind of trouble. So it's much more difficult than it was in 2009 to stimulate their way out of this. I think they might have to let the deflationary forces of a property bust play out. And that would mean, it would be a positive thing for a lot of people that were looking to buy new property, new buyers, but it'd be a very negative thing for a lot of Chinese families that have invested in property as a second, third, and fourth home.
And the danger, I think, when countries have a poor economy, they often turn to war to take their citizens' minds off that, and China's got their eye on Taiwan.
Yeah, the big thing about China, too, is the employment situation. They've got such a large number of jobs that they have to fill, and they always have a lot of people on every job compared to us. They would have two or three times as many people on a similar job, whether it be building an apartment or building an oil sands plant or a nuclear power plant. And they've done that for decades. And so if they get into trouble with having too many young people that can't find jobs, they'll go for desperate measures for sure. I don't know if invading Taiwan is the best thing for them to do, because they don't have a robust navy yet, but they certainly have lots of soldiers they could send. So the question is, how do you transport them? So I don't know what the, I don't know if war is going to be the solution, or whether they'll just go through a slump. I mean, in North America, we've been through, you know, if you go back a couple hundred years, we've been through some pretty big slumps. So we managed to get through them and actually came out the other side better off in some ways. You know, the slump in the 1930s, for example, wiped out almost all the debt in the system. And it took almost 100 years to build the debt back up, and compared to what we had in 1929. But we've accomplished it. Now we have a higher private sector debt than we did in 1929. So maybe that's the cycle. Maybe that's what has to happen. And I sure would like to see the private sector debt get dealt with. And unfortunately, the fastest way to do it, of course, is to let people fail, whether it be companies or, you know, people that have borrowed money to speculate on real estate. The wiping out of debt in bankruptcy is one of the most efficient ways of doing it, compared to government just pumping more and more money into it and ordering the banks to put more money into it, which doesn't really resolve anything. Prices don't come down, and they can't be, you know, people can't get through the cycle properly. They get stuck in a, when Japan did it that way, and that's the way Japan had a peak in 1989, they called them zombie corporations. These corporations were they couldn't pay their debts. They couldn't do anything. They couldn't invest in anything. They just existed, and they held back. Recovery took 25 years in that case. So much better to have a quicker, more efficient, perhaps it's more violent, but it's I think it's more it allows us to get back on track again much more quickly.
The Prime Minister says there's no silver bullet to solve Canada's housing crisis. Well, how about allowing fewer immigrants in? I mean, Canada letting in, what, 500,000 this year? And also, what if the government gave out low-interest loans for first-time buyers? Would that not stimulate more housing?
Well, I think the problem is the private sector was building luxury condos rather than affordable housing, and whatever it would take for the government to do, I think just stimulating demand through the buyer side is not going to do it, because the private sector still wants to build what they've been building in the past. Nobody really wants to build low-income housing, and the last time it was done was in the 70s and the early 80s, and that was done by government direct involvement. So that's the conundrum, and I don't know that the governments are ready to give up on the idea that the private sector knows best when it comes to housing. But it looks to me like they're going to have to. They're going to have to either direct somebody to build affordable housing or open up a. I mean, I know there's lots of listeners will be saying, "Oh my God, if the government does it, it'll be a disaster." But. And it is, to some degree, in the past, has been a problem with what the government ends up doing. But we have to figure out a way to get some affordable housing built, because most of these new immigrants that are coming into Canada, and most of them are just temporary foreign workers and students, by the way. They're not actually true immigrants in the sense of having a permanent residency. But some of them will stay. Some of them will go back to where they came from. And we have to have the right kind of housing for them. And you know, the McMansions they're building on the outskirts of Toronto are just not going to do it. It's just not the right kind of housing for them.
Yeah, so perhaps we do need government involvement. I mean, Canada did not have homeless people until Jean Chrétien decided to get out of the social housing business in the 90s.
You know, the thing that related to this is the high interest rates. So people have been cutting income tax rates, and I'm all in favor of that on high income people. But one of the advantages of having a high tax rate on high income people is you can then go to them and say, "Hey, if you invest in affordable housing, we'll give you a tax break. We'll give you a tax refund on your high income, and all you have to do is invest. And they did that in the 70s. It had some problems. There was it was called multiple unit residential building, MURB, MURBs.
Yeah, MURBs. Yeah.
Even today, I find people that are still holding on to those, because when you sell it, you get the great tax credit up front, but when you sell it, some of that tax has to be recaptured. So they're reluctant to sell and pay the tax that's sort of been deferred for indefinitely. But it actually worked. It provided housing. And of course, I mean, who knows for sure, because there was right after that MERB boom in the late 70s, there was a huge slump in the economy in 1982. So we don't know. And that's the other thing that could solve the problem more quickly, would be just a change in the, you get back to this demand side. People are still willing to borrow a large number of dollars, if the bank will approve it, to buy what seems like pretty modest housing that's been priced pretty expensively, and a slump that lasts for more than a few months. So not like the one we had in 2020, but a bigger slump than that might change people's minds about that, and that could bring prices down quickly. That by itself is just a real. I call it a bursting of the bubble, if you want to use the phraseology that I used in my book. If the bubble bursts, then that'll reset the market in a way that's good for a lot of people. The majority of the people would benefit from a bursting of the bubble.
How big of a correction do you think would happen if we have a recession? And will we have a recession in 2024?
So the correction in some parts of there is a bit of a correction going on, and then who knows? And then we had that money pumped into the economy in 2020, but that correction in parts of Canada was as great as 20%. We'll never know exactly, because the index for housing, they decided to exclude large expensive houses from it if they're an anomaly. So that's where you get your bigger percentage drops, but. So far we've been the worst percentage drop we've had is probably 10 to 15 to 20% at the most, depending on what part of Canada you're talking about and what type of housing. In the U.S., on average, in 2009 or 2010, at the bottom of the correction that started in 2006, it was 38% lower on average, and in parts of the U.S. like Las Vegas, and that it was over 50%. So. That would be for a bursting of the bubble, that would be what you'd want to see. You'd want to see, to really call it a true housing bubble burst, you'd have to look in the range of 35 to 40% minimum. And that's just hard to fathom for a lot of people. But, that wouldn't take us back to really cheap houses. It would just take us back to 2005 or 2010 or something like that. And we could then move on. Incomes need to come up as well for people to be able to afford housing in Canada. Incomes in Canada especially, but in Australia and a few other countries, incomes are unusually low compared to housing prices, which are unusually high. Like in the U.S., on average, incomes are much higher in the U.S. than Canada. That gap has gotten worse in the last 40 years since I've been watching it. But in house prices are 50 to 100% higher in Canada. So lower incomes, higher house prices. It's not a good formula for success, because that leaves very little money for people to invest in more productive assets, like investing in the stock market or investing in new electric cars or something that would be useful. Canada doesn't have much in the way of a stake in the sweepstake that's happening with new electric cars, and the momentum is building pretty rapidly, especially in China, but even in Europe, and now even in Canada and the U.S., it's close to 10% of all new cars are electric in Canada and the U.S. It's something like 25% in China and about 18 to 20% in Europe. So it's happening quite quickly. And Canada doesn't have any factories. There's a couple of factories that are being converted from existing factories, and there's a couple of new battery factories that are being built in Ontario with massive government subsidies. But I don't know of any major factory that's pumping out hundreds of cars a day in Canada, which would be nice, because people would be more likely to buy electric cars if there was a Canadian equivalent.
Yeah, and one that could stand Canadian winters, notwithstanding the Globe and Mail story saying winter's obsolete.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, how do you think the stock markets are going to do in the new year?
Well, so we had a very interesting 2 years. So 2 years ago, almost exactly to the day, bear market started. And the market went down about 20% from, let's say, January 1st, 2022 to October 2022. So about a 10-month bear market, 20% drop, a little bit more than 25% in some aspects of the market. And then we had this rally. And now we're back to where, starting in October 22 up to July of 2023, we had a big rally, and then we had another big slump, and then we've had another big rally. So now we're basically back in the stock market, as measured by the U.S. anyway, to where we are close to the price we were at when this bear market started. So it doesn't mean it's a new bull market, but it sure makes you wonder if we're still in a bear market. So the question for 2024 is there going to be a recession, and is there going to be a continuation of the bear market? And I'm on the side of yes to both of those questions, but most people have changed their view. That's not the consensus view anymore. It was the consensus view a year ago, but now the people have, understandably, they've decided, well, this market's pretty strong, and so we must be going for a soft landing. Interest rates are going to come down. We'll get a soft landing, and somehow these stock prices are going to make sense. The problem with that is that the stock prices are still very expensive, and that's usually never happens in a true bear market. The stock prices get quite cheap at the end of a bear market. That's just where people, the people talk about capitulation, where people just throw away good companies for a really cheap price. And it happened in 2009. It happened in 2002. And I think it'll happen again next year in 2024. Now, that means that the stock market has to come down at least 20%, but probably a little bit more than that for it to become a true correction in the stock market that warrants a bear market designation. And in the recession now, this is a little bit more complicated. There's lots of signs of recession in Canada. Canada's had now 5 quarters of negative GDP growth when you adjust for the number of people in Canada. China's awfully close to a slump. Germany is technically in a recession. And other countries like Australia are going through what Canada's going through in terms of worrying about a property bubble bursting. So we haven't seen the impact of these higher interest rates yet hit. We don't know if it's going to trigger a recession, but the inverted yield curve has been virtually 100% accurate, and the yield curve has been inverted for quite a long time now. So in the U.S., where the 2-year interest rate is higher than the 5 or 10-year interest rate, and almost every time, I think maybe even every time that's happened, there's been a recession. So we haven't had that prediction come true yet with the recession. But a recession right now, with the stock prices still being quite expensive, especially with what they call the Magnificent Seven, would probably be enough to get that bear market resolution finalized. And that can happen fairly quickly. Bear markets can do their damage in a very short period of time. The ultimate being October 1987, when we had a 20% correction in one day. But normally it takes a little bit longer than one day, sometimes 6 months, 9 months, whatever. So this has been an unusually long recession. The average recession when there's a bear market, is about 2 years, and we've already had a 2-year bear market if you count from the peak. So this is going to obviously go into overtime, and I guess the big question mark is how bad will these interest rates bite into the stock market and into the economy.
Well, the Canadian banking industry saw 60,000 layoffs this year, one of the worst years ever in the industry. Is that a precursor of what's going to happen to other sectors?
Yeah, you know, the Canadian banking sector reporting is very, it's not as good, let's put it this way, it's not as good as the U.S. where you can look at the banks and see what, who they're lending to and how, whether there's growth in that sector or not. But the Canadian sector, the Canadian banking is very heavily dependent on retail, what they call retail banking, mortgages, credit cards, HELOCs, car loans, that sort of thing, all related to the household. And we know the household is struggling. And one of the more transparent reporters in the system is Canadian Tire. Canadian Tire is really tuned into the retail customer. And they have said now two quarters in a row, so for 6 months now, they've been saying that the Canadian consumer is really struggling. So the banks, it's kind of noisy because they've got operations in the U.S. and they've got capital markets operations, you know, the things they own, wealth management companies. It's complicated. But when you look at their direct lending, they're obviously there's a slowdown happening. Mortgage lending is basically flat, and in some cases in the Canadian banking system, as much as 20% of their customers or mortgage customers are not able to pay the full cost of the amortized mortgage. Some of them are not even covering the interest on the mortgage. So that's a very so if you reset those people and said, okay, now this $1,500 a month payment you've been making, you have to put it at up to $3,000 to get back on the 25-year amortization. We don't know what would happen to those people because we haven't done it yet. Several of the banks said that they phoned, one of the banks in particular said they phoned people and asked them to get back on the regular payments, and the people agreed. But that's not necessarily the end of the story, because if you get a phone call from the bank and the bank says, oh, you got to get back on, most people are going to say, yeah, okay, I'm fine with that. But you check back 3 months later and see if they actually were able to make those payments. So we're still at that point. But the Canadian Tire indicator is a pretty good one, and they've found that people are spending less money on their purchases. They're still coming; the traffic's still coming through, but they're just not spending as much money. And of course, post Christmas is the time when you start seeing whether people are really struggling with their credit card payments. So that's the area to watch is credit card payments. Car loans is another big one, and because car prices, of course, went up quite a bit, and of course the mortgage payments as well. So we can sort of, if we read between the lines with the bank reports, we can get an idea. We got 2 months more to wait until the banks report again at the end of February. But we'll know more at that point.
The Trudeau government apparently is working on universal income of about $2,000 a month. What would that do to inflation and the job market?
Well, the universal basic income has been around for quite a while, and I had a brief look into it when March 2020 came, and all kinds of people were told they had to stay home from work, and of course, the government decided that they needed to put some money into the bank accounts of those people. So it was done in a very hurried way, and with businesses, they have these CEBA loans, which we could talk about. There's a big uproar over repayment of those loans. The deadline is tomorrow, I think, for a lot of people. And some of the people got an extension to January. So in a way, in a very clumsy, haphazard, inefficient way, they tried the universal basic income in 2020 by just making sure everybody had some money in their bank account, whether they'd lost their job or whether they owned a small business or whether they are a landlord if they were a business tenant in a retail shopping center or something. All those people got money put into their bank account. And in my opinion, it went really badly. Like, it was not a good result. Shortly after that, inflation started to rise, and we didn't necessarily get more people in the job market, so there still were shortages of people applying for jobs. I mean, the whole thing seems like it was really a difficult situation. And, of course, the one thing you do not want is a resurgence of inflation right now, because all of us, I was in the camp that said inflation would last longer than the banks, the central banks who were saying inflation is going to be transitory. So I sort of turned out to be right. But now, the surprise now has been how quickly inflation is coming down. And that caught me a bit by surprise. I thought that the inflation would endure at 6, 7, 8% faster, longer, I mean, than it has. But it's trending back down to 3 to 4%. Now, assuming they're measuring it correctly, which is another whole story. But if inflation were to perk back up to 5, 6%, that would be a really negative sign for a lot of people, because then the soft landing scenario comes completely off the table. And so universal basic income seems likely to be the kind of thing that might trigger that inflation. If people get money, the human nature being what it is, they like to spend it. And they sometimes, if the money came quickly to them, as we discovered in 2020, they didn't care what they were paying. You know, the restaurants jacked up their prices. Ski resorts jacked up the lift ticket prices. Everybody jacked up their prices. Inflation went much higher. So I think it would have to be done very carefully, and the experiment that we saw in 2020 didn't work out very well.
In Vancouver, they took a group of 50 homeless people and gave them $7,500 each. And it was about 90% successful. They found places to live, found jobs, signed up for job training or education. Would something like that help?
Yeah, that's the thing that I think a targeted situation with some definite parameters and some limited scope, so they could see whether it would work. I mean, it's so different from putting money to homeless people who probably don't even have bank accounts, so I'm not quite sure how they did that, compared to just dumping thousands of dollars into everybody's bank account, whoever they were, is a completely different thing. You know, we haven't talked much about modern monetary theory for a while, but this is the idea that modern monetary people, if you go up to the high level, they said you can print money and put it into the economy, and they don't, you know, it isn't even really technically printing money according to the MMT people. As long as you tax it back out of the system, so as long as you tax enough of that money back, not because you need to tax the money to get money to run government, because they claim that you don't need to raise money through taxes to pay for government. Government can create its own money out of thin air, but if you just leave the money in the system without taxing it back, you create runaway inflation. So we've already seen that part of the experiment. And so what we need to do is maybe do something like that on a very limited basis and see if it works without causing inflation. Because if it causes inflation, then nobody's really doing very well. I mean, I'm sure the homeless people will be happy to have a home, but in general, in the broad population, that's not going to work if all it does is create inflation.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thanks, Jim.
Hope you can find some snow.
Yeah, well, we'll have to, you know, sort of jump in the air and over the rocks and land on the snow patches. I guess that's the challenge, I guess.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. If you have any questions for Hilliard or for any of our guests, you can send them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on X at HowStreet. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at talkdigitalnetwork.com. HowStreet.com Radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.